So, at the end of the 7th chapter, then Krishna mentioned 6 terms. He said here, those in full consciousness of me, who know me as the Supreme Lord, to be the governing principle of the material manifestation, the demigods, and of all methods of sacrifice, can understand and know me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even at the time of death. So then, with chapter 8, then it opens that Arjuna then inquires about these points that Krishna has just made. So these are the points where Brahman, Adiatma, Karma, Adibhuta, Adidaiva, and Adiyagya. Arjuna inquired, O my Lord, O Supreme Person, what is Brahman? What is the Self? What are fruitive activities? What is this material manifestation? And what are the demigods? Please explain this to me. So Arjuna's first point is he wants to know what is Brahman. Does that mean the living entities or the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Who is Brahman? Because Krishna in the previous verse said that they are Brahman. Intelligent persons who are endeavoring for liberation from old age and death take refuge in me in devotional service. They are actually Brahman because they entirely know everything about transcendental activities. So he was asking, what is this Brahman? What do you mean by this? Prabhupada explains in the purport, it says, Aham Brahmasmi, I am spirit. It is said that one should understand that he is Brahman, spirit soul. This Brahman conception of life is also in devotional service. The pure devotees are transcendentally situated on the Brahman platform, and they know everything about transcendental activities. Only persons who perform activities in Krishna consciousness, mam ashtarita, are actually entitled to be called Brahman, because they are actually endeavoring to reach the Krishna planet. Such persons have no misgivings about Krishna, unless they are factually Brahman. That's from 729 purport. Then Baladev Vidyabhushan, and he makes a point that in this, what is Arjuna asking about it? On the Adiatma, he wants to know if the Adiatma pertains to the gross or subtle body. Then on Karma, he wants to know if they refer to fruitive or spiritual activities. And then, depending on which they are, he wants to know why he has to fight. Is it material, you know, or spiritual like this? What is Adibhuta? He's asking what gross material things is he referring to? Is he talking about the body, or is he talking about pots and pans around the house, or what he's talking about? And then Adidaiva, is that some bigger demigod, you know, like Indra or someone like that, or is that the universal form? And then Bhurijan Prabhu points out that the prefix adhi is significant. One of the definitions of it is above, over, and above, or over and above. These are given. Yeah. Or, yeah. Like that. So then, and then he asks about the last part of Krishna's point. Who is the Lord of sacrifice, and how does he live in the body? O Madhusudana. And how can those engaged in devotional service know you at the time of death? Because he said in the previous chapter that he can know one even at the time of death. So he wants to know, how does that work? See, this is the natural point when we ask questions or when we think, is we've heard from the Shastra or we hear from the spiritual master, other devotees, but then the mind should be inquisitive. Well, how does that apply? Okay, I've heard it. It sounds nice. I have no questions like that. But then there comes the point of you have to apply it. And when we apply it, that's when we start to run into little technical difficulties. The art of it, as Krishna points out, the art of work. When that art is understood, then it gets done. So he says, one who knows me, even at the time of death. So then Arjuna wants to know, well, how do you know? I mean, what does that mean? What do you mean by one who knows me? You know, just they heard his name, or they know his address or something, or... you know, if you line up 10 people in a line, you can point out which one is Krishna, or, you know, what does it mean by one who knows me? Like that. What is that? So this, the point is that Arjuna is inquisitive because he wants to apply what is being taught. Right? If we want to apply what we learn, then we're inquisitive how it gets done. If it's obvious or we can figure it out, fine. But if not, we want to know. We don't just leave it at that. If there's something we want to do and we have part information of it to get it done, then we'll endeavor to find the balance. So that's the process of questioning. So questions and answers, and Prabhupada says, then this becomes the perfect reciprocation between the teacher and the taught. So he is now asking questions. Just on Krishna makes a point and immediately says, okay, what do you mean by that? He doesn't just leave it. But it's like, if he doesn't understand, he asks. One, if we're free from ego, then we don't mind asking. Otherwise, then we may think, well, it may sound foolish. You know, it's obvious. But if it was obvious, then we wouldn't have a question. Or even if we do have a question, there's some doubt or something else, then we ask. And that's not a fault. Right? If the purpose is to actually want to know, it is not a fault. If it's just to ask something just to show that you asked something, you know, just I'm so intelligent, and Prabhupada said, you know, if you're intelligent, you'll ask questions, so I'm showing how I'm intelligent, I'm asking some question. And that's not necessary. But this is, in wanting to apply it, we are asking. This is good. Okay. Okay, so now Krishna answers his questions there very succinctly in two verses here. This is 3 and 4. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, the indestructible, transcendental living entity is called Brahman, and his eternal nature is called Adiatma, the Self. Action pertaining to the development of the material bodies of the living entities is called karma, or fruit of activities. O best of the embodied beings, the physical nature, which is constantly changing, is called Adibhuta, the material manifestation. The universal form of the Lord, which includes all the demigods, like those of the sun and moon, is called Adidaiva. And I, the Supreme Lord, represented as the Supersoul in the heart of every embodied being, am called Adiyagya, the Lord of Sacrifice. So then in these points here, then he wants to know what is Brahman. So Prabhupada makes the point here. Brahman is indestructible and eternally existing, and its constitution is not changed at any time. But beyond Brahman, there is Parabrahman. Brahman refers to the living entity, and Parabrahman refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, this term, Brahman, can refer to both the living entity and the Lord. But he was asking, so, who are you referring to? So, Prabhupada points out that here, in this discussion, where we're calling the living entity Brahman, that means the Lord will be called Parabrahman. And if we're giving a general term meaning spiritual, then that may apply to either. But when we're making distinctions, then the soul is Brahman, and the Lord is Parabrahman. Right? So that is the nature of the living entity. Then the second point is, what is the self? Okay, now we heard about Brahman, or the soul. Now what is the self? Because Krishna mentions both. So then, Prabhupada writes here, the constitutional position of the living entity is different from the position he takes in the material world. Material consciousness is nature's to try to be the lord of matter. But in spiritual consciousness, Krishna consciousness, his position is to serve the Supreme. So the self means one's consciousness, that one is actually the servant of the Lord. That is the self. Because we have the soul. We can say Tathasta Shakti, 1/10,000, the tip of the hair, Sat Chit Ananda. But who is that? So what is that personality? Just like we say, oh, who is that person? Oh, that person, well, let's see, he's, you know, 5'7", 153 pounds, wearing a white dhoti with a green border on it and a chadar and three strands of neck beads. Does that answer your question? Does it? Will anybody be satisfied with that answer? No. They want to know who he is, what he does, what his relationships, what is his position, how does he kind of, his personality, how he deals. Then we say, oh, now I know who, I understand. Right? We say, oh, that's the temple president, and you know, he's, you know, been here for 10 years, and like that. Then you say, oh, now I know who it is. So we just say, who's that? You just say, well, that's a soul. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, we understand, okay, yes, that we understand. But when we say, what is the self? And then we say, the eternal servant of the Lord. So that consciousness that one is the eternal servant of the Lord, that is the self. So this makes the distinction there. In other words, the distinction between just the tattva of the living entity and actually the living entity's, how he, what is his position? You know, what is the actual nature? Like that. That is being pointed out here. So one has to know both. That's the point being made here, is one has to know that we are not the body, we're the soul, we're separate from material nature. But we have to know what is the nature of that soul? What does he do? What is his position, constitutional position? Then we understand he's not the body, he's soul, he's different, transcendental. But not still, what is his activities? Otherwise the Mayavadis only come up to the first one. This the soul. Oh, okay, then we think that's fine. But because we think material activities means relationships, this, that, but spiritual activities don't mean any of that. Right? We, you know, it's just, you know, there's a cloud with an om sign in it, and, you know, one floats around there. It's nice. But the point is it's not like that. It's relationships between the living entity and the Supreme Lord. That is what's important. So we must distinguish between the two. The soul means, we say, the soul is the eternal servant of God. So we've mentioned both of them there. We always mention these, but we may not distinguish. We say the living entity is the eternal servant of Krishna. So we identify, you know, the jiva tattva, the Brahman, and then we say what he's supposed to do. What is his position? So that's the soul and the self, or the Brahman and the self, or the Adiatma. Okay. Then the third point is, what is karma? So here's pointed out, it's not just activity, but it's that activity which creates future material activity, in other words, the material body. Prabhupada points out here, when the living entity is in material consciousness, he has to take on various bodies in the material world. That is called karma, or varied creation by the force of material consciousness. Then Burjan points out that in his purport, he gives a detailed description of karma from the Chandogya Upanishad. In that, in the technical sense, it means the journey of the jiva to the heavenly planets, his return to earth, and his acquiring a human body after falling from the heavens in the form of rain. So this whole cycle where the living entity performs particular activities, pious activities that elevates him to the to the heavenly planets. They spend some time there. Then he falls in the form of rain and again appears here. So that cycle, we call samsara, that cycle, that is karma. So it's not just the reaction, it's the body in which all these things are done. So we see the change of body, going from human to demigod, rain, and then back to human. We know why it's said they fall as rain, how that works. You heard like that? Pretty much. Okay. So that's an interesting point that the Vedas generally don't talk about too much like that, at least not the karmakanda. That is why Krishna calls it the flowery language of the Vedas. Is that it will describe that you go to the heavenly planets, you'll enjoy there, this, that. There's no death. So there is no death on the heavenly planets. No one dies there. That doesn't mean that the residents of the heavenly planets don't die. They just don't die on the heavenly planet. they fall from the heavenly planet. And when they're in this space, the antariksha, between Bhuvar Swa. So on the Bhuvar, that is the space in between, the antariksha. And in the antariksha, that is where the planets of the, you know, the yakshas, rakshasas, you know, prates and pisachas and all these kind of personalities live. So as the demigod is falling from the heavenly planet, he's still alive. And then when he passes through the antariksha, then the rakshasas and others see him, and then they think, ah, here comes dinner. And not being overly cultured and all that, you know, they don't necessarily send out an invitation to the demigod for him to come. He's not formally invited like that. And they just come and they just start eating him without any, you know, particular formalities, you know. They're not into all the rituals and all that. So they just come and start eating him as he is falling through the space. So naturally, it will not be an overly pleasant experience. You know, it's just you're minding your own business. You're just falling through space because your pious activities ran out on the heavenly planets. And, you know, nothing better to do. And then the rakshasas and all that come along, and just because you're in their territory, they think it's their right to eat you. So naturally, as you're falling through the space, people come up and start, you know, grabbing your arm and chewing on it and things like that. It would be rather unnerving. So then the living entity, out of the pain of this, leaves the body through the tears. And so that tears then fall as rain. So when the rain is falling, then that jiva, now in the drop of water, the tear, falls with the other rain, and then they take birth as blade of grass, like that. Or they get born into the grains, and the human eats the grains, and then they're in the body, and then they get injected into the womb. So the first birth is that of grass. Next birth then is human. You know? But the Karmakanda section generally avoids these descriptions. As we see here, this has come from Chandogya Upanishad. So that's the philosophical portion of the Vedas. So those, that's generally for the renunciates, the sannyasis, and those who are mainly interested in philosophy, not in karma. They read that section. And those interested in karma generally don't read the Upanishads. They read the Brahmanas and other sections that deal with all the rituals and the fruits that they'll get. So it's all there. But the flowery language is in the other sections, and then the reality is in the Upanishads. Like that. So one finds that out later. You know, hopefully not too late. So. By Prabhupada's grace, then, in the very beginning, then he gives us the knowledge of the Upanishads and the Ishopanishad. Okay, so now we've distinguished between the body, the soul, and action, activity, karma. So that activity which is done with material purpose is called karma. But that activity done without material purpose or desire is not karma. You know? Therefore, the point that he gives in the previous chapter, intelligent persons who are endeavoring for liberation from old age and death take refuge in me in devotional service. They are actually Brahman, because they entirely know everything about transcendental activities. So they know how to perform transcendental activities. That makes them Brahman. Prabhupada points out that only the devotee actually can be Brahman. Others actually never are. Brahmavadis, they're accepted like that, but they're not actually, because they don't fully know what it is. They have a portion, they're partially understanding their position as Brahman. Then the fourth point, what is Adibhuta? Srila Prabhupada writes, the physical nature is considered constantly changing. Materially, bodies generally pass through six stages. They are born, they grow, they remain for some duration, they produce some byproducts, they dwindle, and then they vanish. This physical nature is called Adibhuta. It is created at a certain point and will be annihilated at a certain point. So that is the Adibhuta. So what is controlling the Bhuta? So the elements. Bhuta means the elements, like earth, water, fire, air, ether. That's the Bhuta. So then, what is controlling that? So he says here the material nature is controlling that. That is being carried out. physical nature is constantly changing. So karma is what you're doing within that, and this is what is going on there. And then who is the Adidaiva? Then Prabhupada mentions here, the conception of the universal form of the Supreme Lord, which includes all the demigods and their different planets, is called Adidaiva. And then Srila Prabhupada in the Bhagavatam describes that the universal form is the Adidaiva. Like that. So this universal form means all the demigods are in there and they're doing their duties. So the universal form is the explanation of Krishna in the material world, how he has entered with his different opulences, his different energies. So these energies are then given to different demigods. Therefore, the Virat Purusa is the Adidaiva. The devatas themselves are, they get their power and energy from the Virat Purusa. Like that. We could turn on that light that goes on. Otherwise, the combination of me half asleep and the audience half asleep ends up because everybody is asleep. He makes an interesting point here. Whether one is worshipping the Lord or his gigantic material form, this also pleases the demigods. Either one. So if one is accepting and worshipping the universal form, that pleases the demigods because they are getting their position from the Lord. They are getting their energy from the Lord. Or if one worships the transcendental form of the Lord, they are also satisfied because the transcendental form of the Lord is the origin of the Virat Purusha. So in either case, then this is what is going on. So it says, Prabhupada says, consequently, for the materialist also, worship of the gigantic universal form of the Lord leads one to the right path. One need not risk being misled by approaching many demigods for fulfillment of different desires. The real entity is the Lord himself, and all others are imaginary, for everything is included in him only. So even if one wants material desires and one approaches the universal form, still that is going in the right direction. There's not complete knowledge. Just like the Brahmavadis are not complete knowledge of transcendence. So in this way, one is performing his activities, he's not in complete knowledge if he worships the universal form. Then his last point is, what is Adiyagya? And where in the body does he live? Prabhupada writes here, present in the body along with the individual soul is the Supersoul, a plenary representation of Lord Krishna. The Supersoul is called the Paramatma, or Adiyagya, and is situated in the heart. So the conclusion of all this is that Krishna is the governing principle behind all these elements. He's behind all sacrifice. What's it here? It says, the governing principle of the material nature, what is carrying out everything, the Lord of the demigods, and the methods of sacrifice. So if we understand that he is behind all this, the Adidaiva, Adibhuta, and Adiyagya, then Krishna says one can know him even at the time of death. So that brings us to So the point then is that if he does his duties as working, fighting on the battlefield, at the same time remembering Krishna as the Lord of these three, then he will make spiritual advancement, because then he's on the platform of Brahman. This is the all these different things that have been said before. As we understand, Krishna has pointed out that the material energy is carrying out all the activities. So the three modes of nature are getting everything done. We're simply desiring. But the Lord of the material nature of the three modes is Krishna. Then these, how you say, and all yajna all sacrifice, performing their prescribed duties for getting results, then the ultimate lord of sacrifice is Vishnu, is Krishna. And his point here of the, how do you say, the source of the Virat Purush, is that whatever is going on here, means we're saying material nature is carrying that out, but he is the source of all the potency, how the material nature can function. So, understanding this, then we can do the duties without attachment, without desire for results, for pleasing Krishna, because he is the ultimate goal of all these activities. Then it becomes very nice. And Krishna continues here about this point of remembering Krishna at the time of death. This is text 5. And whoever at the end of his life quits his body, remembering me alone, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. Therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, and at the same time carry out your prescribed duty of fighting. With your activities dedicated to me, and your mind and intelligence fixed on me, you will attain me without doubt. He who meditates on me is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his mind constantly engaged in remembering me, undeviated from the path, he, O Partha, is sure to reach me. So Krishna makes it very clear that whatever you remember at the time of death, that's where you go. That's it. That's a very simple point. Whatever you remember, that's where you're going to go. But now the point is that therefore he makes, after he says that, then the next two points are how one should act. He says, after saying that, after he says this, whatever state of mind one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state will attain without fail. Then he says, therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, at the same time carry out your prescribed duty of fighting. So, the whole point is that we're practicing that point. It means at the time of death, you have to remember Krishna only. So that means when we're doing our activities, we have to remember Krishna. Because what we do in our life is going to be heavily influenced on what we think of at the time of death. That will be, what have we done, that will be the influence. That will be our sphere of activities that we're going to choose from. What we're going to fall back on is the time of death, and there's generally one is trying to, you know, grab onto something. Something that one considers a substance, something more most dear. And if some difficulty comes, then you think of something that's dear to you, something you feel that will mean something for you, and you think that this will save you. Right? Materialist likes to surround himself. He thinks his nice house, his position, all these different things, the family members are going to save him. So at the time of death, he remembers these things. So for the devotee, he remembers Krishna. But how? By doing one, while performing prescribed duties, one remembers. One practices that. And doing it for Krishna. Then it comes out very nice. Otherwise, it becomes more difficult. Oh yeah, Krishna mentions in 6th chapter, 35th verse, remembering him takes constant practice and determination. So we start that now. That's the idea. Rather than just wait till we get old, but we start now, doing our prescribed duties. Generally one thinks, well, I'll take up spiritual life, you know, when I get older. And after I've done all my material activities, older, you know, children are grown up, businesses with them, or other things like this, and then we can dedicate ourselves, right? Once we've fulfilled all our material desires and all that. So then, but what is not being understood is that performance of your duties, you know, even in the Grihastha Ashram, whatever it is, so many ideas are there, so many plans. But if that is done for Krishna, without that attachment, without desiring the results, just doing. Because one is supposed to do that. That is also sacrifice. That is, you are also elevating yourself then. Arjuna is fighting for a kingdom, but he's doing it to please Krishna. Because he's performing his duty. That's his duty, what he's supposed to do. Then one understands that from today I can take up serious spiritual life. I don't have to wait until I get old or until all material desires are gone. No, performing the duties of your particular ashram and activities, that is sacrifice. If that is understood, one understands that's how you purify oneself. Therefore, the concept that prayaschitya will purify anyone is a foolish idea. Right? Means this idea of prayaschitya means some material activity, external activity, is actually what's going to purify us if we've done something wrong. It's specifically for those who are materially attached. The prayaschitya process is very dear to those who are materially attached. Someone's attached to going to the heavenly planets, attached to the, the processes to get themselves to the heavenly planets. So if someone does something against this or impious, right, these activities are pious. Someone does something impious, then one feels that because that was an external activity, I had some ingredients, I took my body, some mantras are chanted, some different activities, some charity was given, then I'll become pious and elevated. So if I do some material nonsense that's not pious, then also in the same logic, an external material activity is going to free me from that. Right? Because I am this whole calculation, I'm not in any way considering my consciousness and my motives behind my activities. You know, who is the Adi Yajna? Who is the Adi Daiva? Who is the Adi Bhuta? I'm not considering any of that. I do this activity, I get this pious heavenly result. So if I do something that may get in the way of that, I expect there'll be another, you know, bodily activity that will then correct the situation. In other words, I'm totally absorbed in what I can see with my senses. Right? That's my point. I am using the method or the position of religion or manamoy, but what do I want? I want anamoy. Right? Heavenly planets means my body will be better, you know, the situation will be better, the facilities will be better, you know, the exchanges between other people will be better quality sense gratification. Our interest is in the senses. Right? That's where the interest actually lies. You know, therefore, it's not, one may think, well, it seems strange that after going to the heavenly planets, the next birth is that as a blade of grass. But if you look at it from this standpoint, it's not. Right? Because all one is interested is eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But on a very high, refined level. Right? They're not interested in... So therefore, it's not a whole lot better than being a blade of grass. You know, you've been a big, big demigod, so now you be humble, little blade of grass, everyone will come and step on you. You know, like this. So it goes... Now... So this prayaschitya then is for that kind of mentality. And according to the scriptures, it only removes one quarter of the reaction of karma. Right? And that's, you know, because you went to the trouble of performing the prescribed thing. But actually the real prayaschitya is devotional service itself. Because in that, you're performing your activities, but without desire for the fruit. And this means then it's not being done for karma. It's not karma anymore. It's being done as a sacrifice to the Lord. Right? Directly, not indirectly, but directly. And because of this, it does not generate another body. If you do something wrong, it just means it generates another body. But it will be not a good situation, right? Sinful means uneducated, not one doesn't look very nice, not very wealthy, legal difficulties, your chronic diseases. These kind of things are symptoms of sinful reactions. So then pious are the opposite, you know, very beautiful, educated, wealthy, good position, you know, all these kind of things. So now I've done something wrong, it's going to create for me a bad body. Right? So I do the prayaschitya so that I continue just to get good body. But either way, it's karma. But when you do it without desire for the result, it's not karma anymore. Right? It becomes spiritual. So the karma aspect is removed. So that's the real prayaschitya. That's where Prabhupada always makes the point. If one does something wrong, one should absorb oneself more in devotional service. Because only that will remove the desires and the growing. It means you've had so many desires in past lives, even in this life, it's already started growing the plants. The weeds have already started. So now chanting will remove all that. Devotional service will remove all that. The prayaschitya doesn't remove any of that. It just removes the sinful reaction. It doesn't take out the desire seed. So the desire seed will grow again. It's just a matter of, you know, it's like you have a weed in the ground. Growing in the ground, if I cut along and just cut the top off, I haven't taken out the root. So it's just I come back in another day or two and you'll see the weeds there again. But if I take it and pull it out by the root, I can come back after a couple of days and see nothing's there. So prayaschitya just does like that. Just removes it for right now. This lifetime or immediately for next lifetime. Like that. So the main thing is devotional service. That is the point. We understand this, then we know what is the real thing to do when people have difficulties. They have to be engaged more in devotional service. You know, more strictly, with greater fixed determination, like that. Then one actually gets benefit. Otherwise, then if we want to take the material, then we have to take according to the rules. Right? There's material rules for what material thing you do counters some material wrong. So now Krishna points out now how one can remember Krishna. What is the process for remembering? So he said, if you remember, like that, he explained that aspect and basically how to practically do it here. Now, he said to remember him while doing your duties. He's become a little more specific. Now he'll get even more specific than that. Text 9. One should meditate on the Supreme Person as one who knows everything, as he who is the oldest, who is the controller, who is smaller than the smallest, who is the maintainer of everything, who is beyond all material conception, who is inconceivable and who is always a person. He is luminous like the sun and he is transcendental, beyond this material creation. So he's given ten different ways we can meditate upon the Lord here. All these different aspects. And if we, so while we're thinking of the Lord, these are the ways we can think. He's the oldest, smaller than the smallest. He's the controller. You know, whatever is going on, whatever our activity, we can somehow or another think of Krishna in relationship to that. So he's bringing that out here. And Prabhupada says in the purport to this verse, those who are engaged in worshipping the form of the Lord, or who are engaged in meditation on the Lord simply for liberation from material bondage, also know by the grace of the Lord the purports of Brahman, Adibhuta, etc. So if one is fixed, if one is worshipping the deity, or engaged in meditation, both will come to the platform of understanding Brahman. Brahman, Adibhuta, Adidaiva, Adiyagya, all these points that are mentioned here. So this worship of the deity then becomes the very essential aspect of the devotional process for the. Then Krishna continues, text 10. One who at the time of death fixes his life heirs between the eyebrows, and by the strength of yoga, with an undeviating mind, engages himself in remembering the Supreme Lord in full devotion, will certainly attain to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Persons who are learned in the Vedas, who utter Omkara, and who are great sages in the renounced order, enter into Brahman. Desiring such perfection, one practices celibacy. I shall now briefly explain to you the process by which one may attain salvation. The yogic situation is that of detachment from all sensual engagements. Closing all the doors of the senses and fixing the mind on the heart and the life air at the top of the head, one establishes himself in yoga. After being situated in this practice, yoga practice and vibrating the sacred syllable Om, the supreme combination of letters, if one thinks of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and quits his body, he will certainly reach the spiritual practices. So the essential point here is that one is remembering Krishna in this process. One is remembering the Lord. What's interesting here is that you have basically three things that are happening in this whole process. And one is fixing the life air between the eyebrows, because the eyebrows is where the memory is. This chakra between the eyebrows is where the memory is situated. So first he situates it there. Then from that, then he can situate, I say, the life air is at the top of the head, and his, what's it, concentration, and fixing the mind and the heart. Because in the heart, you have to fix the mind. This is dharana. You have to fix the mind somewhere. So by pranayama, one controls the life airs, and by pratyahara, one pulls in the senses, because he says here, one practices celibacy. So then one pulls in the senses, and then one starts to raise the life force. So first he gets it to between the eyebrows and situates himself in yoga. Then he takes it to the top of the head, and now he meditates on the heart, fixes the mind in the heart, because now he's fixing it in one place. That's dharana. After pratyahara, bringing in the senses, then you have to fix it in one place. That's the heart. Then after fixing it in the heart, then he says, then one remembers him. Then one remembers him. So we see the chanting of the holy name. He's chanting here Omkara, and remembering the Lord, this combination, then takes one back to Godhead. Says, quits his body, he will certainly reach the spiritual planets. If one thinks of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and quits his body, he will certainly reach the heavenly planets. So chanting the Lord's name, remembering him exclusively, then one reaches the spiritual planets. That point is being made in this section. Then Krishna starts talking about pure devotional service. For one who always remembers me without deviation, I am easy to obtain. O son of Prita, because of his constant engagement in devotional service. Prabhupada points out in the purport that bhakti is indicated in this verse by the words ananya cheta, without deviation of the mind. And then 16, 15. Okay. Oh, here, it's a nice story here. Here, Bhujan points out, and then he tells the story. Ananya Chaita means undeviating, with no desire for heavenly pleasure or liberation. Satatama Nityasa means always serving with no break, for one's entire life, without consideration of time and place. Krishna is so pleased by such an attitude that he becomes sulabha, easy to obtain. Even if one is not yet on the platform but only desiring to reach it, Krishna removes all obstacles from such a devotee's path. A vivid example illustrating the importance of ananya cheta bhakti is found in Lord Chaitanya's lila. So here it means that you make the endeavor your whole life to always try to remember Krishna, serve Krishna, that even if we're not successful, we made that endeavor, then Krishna is pleased. He will become easily available. What's it? Sulabha. He will become easily available because one has made that endeavor. So that's very pleasing to the Lord. So this story is that Lord Chaitanya one time when he went to the toilet, then he found that his tongue was always chanting. It wouldn't stop chanting. And he was thinking, well, this is not good, because, you know, the Vedic mantras and other such mantras aren't chanted while one is using the toilet, you know, because they're considered sacred and the personalities and all this, and so one doesn't chant them in the toilet. So Lord Chaitanya, you know, being from good Brahmin family, was thinking that this is not good. I had been taught that this is improper to chant these spiritual mantras like this. So then the next thing we see is that Lord Chaitanya comes out of the toilet holding his tongue. Right? He's got his tongue very firmly held like this. Yes, yeah, so then Lord Chaitanya explained, you know, some devotees ask what's going on. You know, and Lord Chaitanya explained, well, I was performing this dirty activity and my tongue was chanting and this is improper. You know, so therefore the only way I could get it to stop chanting, because it wouldn't stop chanting, was to hold it. I tried to stop chanting, but the tongue wouldn't stop. I just grabbed my tongue. Like that. Then one small boy, his name was Gopal, and he came forward and he bravely spoke up here. And Gopal said, no, no, this isn't the correct philosophy. Krishna's names are pure and should be chanted at all times. For instance, if one were about to die, would he think, oh, this is an inauspicious, dirty time, and therefore I shouldn't chant? No, at all times, regardless of the external purity of the situation, one should remember Krishna and chant his names. Then Lord Chaitanya replied, you have properly understood the philosophy. You are my guru. You are Gopal Guru. So we hear about Gopal Guru. You know, he wrote in that's Dhyanachandra. No, Gopal Guru also. Gopal Guru wrote and Dhyanachandra. So Gopal Guru, he wrote one padati on deity worship and that. So he's very well respected. So this is when he was 8 years old. So he was known from that time as Gopal Guru, from when he was 8. So then, yeah. So this is the point, is that one should always remember, like that, always remember the Lord and always chant. We see that it's interesting, after all this yogic process and all that, he's done all these mechanical things to sit in the postures, control the breathing, pull in the senses, fix the mind in one place, and then we start remembering and chanting. Right? One sits down, because from that point, this is what yoga rudha means. This is the advanced stage of yoga. So one can give up work at this point. So the yogi, once he's attained this stage, can sit down, stop all other work, and just meditate upon the Lord. Of course, because, you know, generally one works as one has to eat and those kind of things. But the yogi by this time has given up eating and breathing, you know. So he doesn't have to work. There's nothing to work for. Right? And so but the final stage is remembering the Lord and chanting the Lord's holy name. So it's interesting to note that that point always happens. So in this age, it's like the essence of yoga, the essence of every, like deity worship, you're chanting mantras, there's some rituals are being performed, and you're supposed to remember the Lord. That's the process of deity worship. You first go through the stage called yoga, in which you purify the consciousness, bring it to the proper Krishna conscious standard, spiritual standard, then one performs the activities. Right? So Prabhupada mentions that the main essential elements is that the holy names are always being chanted. You're chanting Om, you're chanting the names of the deity, one's offering one's respect is Namaha. So the chanting is going on, therefore it becomes good. So here Krishna's saying, in the yajnas, they're also all the mantras. It doesn't say if one of the rituals, something goes wrong in it, it's all useless. That you can correct. There's prayaschittas you can do. But it says if one syllable is chanted wrong, then the whole thing's useless. Right? So that means the chanting is the most essential point. Right? And then if you remember the Lord, then the Lord Himself personally comes and to your sacrifice at the final end. And in the Satyuga, then when meditation is the thing, then we see, we get the Lord, but it's still, it's the chanting and remembering. So here Krishna is pointing out, you perform your duties and remember Him. So we should always be chanting and remembering the Lord. Then the essence of yajna, it's the same. So in this age, we're just given that much only. Very little ritual goes with it. In other ages, so much ritual and difficulty is there. You know, the deity worship in the Dwapara Yuga, you would make an offering. Each time you make an offering, so seven offerings a day, you put that on a nice solid gold plate. And then after the offering, you throw it out because it's been used. Right? And next offering is a new gold plate. Like that. So you go through seven new gold plates a day. You know, so you just add that up, and that's just one item. So like this, it's very elaborate. Not possible in this age. The yajna is not possible. The meditation, not possible. But the essence of all the yajnas, chanting the holy name, remembering the Lord, that is given to us. Bas. Do this, and then whatever else assists us become Krishna conscious. So it's a very merciful thing. Therefore, this point is nam nam akadi bahudani ja sarva shaktis. It's so wonderful. Tatarpita niyamita smaranena kalaha. Right? Niyamita smaranena kalaha. You should remember the Lord at any time, and it doesn't matter the time and place where you're chanting. So these essential points are given to us. Then, Krishna continues here. Then with this is 15 and 16. After attaining me, the great souls who are yogis in devotion never return to this temporary world, which is full of miseries, because they have attained the highest perfection. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, such devotees enter Krishna's pastimes and happily take birth when Krishna appears in the house of Vasudeva as his son. Then text 16. From the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery, when repeated birth and death take place. One who attains my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So even you go to all these other planets, you will take birth again. These are all places of misery. And misery means birth, death, old age, and disease. But you go to the spiritual planets, Krishna's place, then one doesn't take birth again. Because that is Vaikuntha, no anxieties. So that means no birth, no death, no old age, no disease. So it's very, Krishna's very nicely made this point. Now Krishna will go on start to describe the spiritual and the material natures. Text 17. By human calculation, 1,000 ages taken together form the duration of Brahma's one day, and such also is the duration of his night. At the beginning of Brahma's day, all living entities become manifest from the unmanifest state, and therefore, when the night falls, they are merged into the unmanifest again. Again and again, when Brahma's day arrives, all living entities come into being, and with the arrival of Brahma's night, they are helplessly annihilated. Yet, there is another unmanifest state, which is eternal and is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It is supreme and is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. That which the Vedas describe as unmanifest and infallible, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having obtained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. So this Krishna is comparing that in the material world, then you have all the living entities, basically except for the top four planetary systems, then they're always being constantly being destroyed. And these living entities are then, their bodies and everything are unmanifest. They remain asleep during Brahma's night. And then when he wakes up in the day, then again the karma starts, the bodies are manifest and everything goes on. So like this, there's no happiness here. It's not eternal. It doesn't have any substance. But Krishna's abode then does. So when we say unmanifest, it means we can't see it here. But it's not manifest. It's always there. This is the difference. Creation, maintenance, and destruction is a feature of the material world. But this feature of the spiritual world is always exists. It's based on sat. So there's always this existence there. Here it's based on sat, means the Brahman is here, but we see it's covered. So it becomes like a shadow, there's a cloud. That's why it describes, because it is Brahman, but it's covered by a cloud. Right? Then one can't understand its position. It becomes shadow. We see the shadow. We don't understand the principle of Brahman on which everything is situated. Therefore, we see everything in this beginning, middle, and end. But Krishna's abode is not like that. It doesn't have, it's always manifest. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, now he tells how to get to that abode. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is greater than all, is obtainable by unalloyed devotion. Although he is present in his abode, he is all-pervading, and everything is situated within him. Oh, best of the... Okay, so he's pointing out unalloyed devotion is how we can get there. Is that this karma, jnana, yoga on their own, they cannot get us there. Only devotional service. So how do we get to that unalloyed devotional service? That is by practicing our duties in consciousness of Him, for Him. That will purify us. That purifies the karma, that purifies the jnana, and it purifies the yoga. So then we can come to this platform of unalloyed devotion. Then we can enter into the spiritual realms. Now Krishna continues. O best of the Bharatas, I shall now describe to you the different times at which, passing from this world, the yogi does or does not come back. Those who know the Supreme Brahman attain that Supreme by passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God, in the light, at an auspicious moment of the day, during the fortnight of the waxing moon, and during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. Prabhupada writes here, when fire, light, day, and the fortnight of the moon are mentioned, it should be understood that over all of them there are various presiding deities who make arrangements for the passage of the soul. The time of death, the mind carries one on the path to a new life. One leaves the body at the time designated above, either accidentally or by arrangement. It is possible for him to obtain the impersonal Brahma-jyoti. Then, the next point he makes, the mystic who passes away from the world during the smoke, the night, the fortnight of the waning moon, or the 6 months when the sun passes to the south, reaches the moon planet, but again comes back. According to Vedic opinion, there are two ways of passing from this world, one in light and one in darkness. When one passes in light, he does not come back. But when one passes in darkness, he returns. Although the devotees know these two paths, O Arjuna, they are never bewildered. Therefore, be always fixed in devotion. A person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing austere sacrifices, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical and fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end he reaches the supreme eternal abode. So even though the devotee knows these two paths, leaving in the night, the dark, or leaving in the light, but it doesn't matter, because both of them, one is the path of karma, one is the path of jnana. But since he's performing his activities for Krishna without the desire for result, he's not performing karma, So there is no karma, there is no jnana. You don't get any of either of these results. So then a person doing devotional service, he gets the benefits of all those. Whatever the activity that is being performed, what is the actual purpose one gets? The results of, here, giving in charity, studying the Vedas, performing sacrifices, philosophical and fruitive activities, they all have a result you're trying to get. And ultimately these have a benefit. So now someone who performs devotional service, he gets the benefits of actually all those. But not, he doesn't take the material results of it. He takes the karma by performing the activities as a sacrifice to Krishna. He doesn't take the fruit of result. He takes the purification and freedom from anarthas that it gives, and the knowledge that is gained by that. With this, then he can go deeper into the actual philosophy of Krishna consciousness, understand the various technical points of of the spiritual nature and the difference between spiritual and material. He can go very deep into this and understand his relationship with the Lord. This gives him understanding of the Lord and situates him on the Brahman platform. So he's gotten the benefit of jnana. He's been situated on the Brahman platform. He's gotten the fruit of the actually useful fruit of karma. He's become purified of all sinful activities, and And he's been situated in knowledge. By practicing the path of knowledge, he becomes situated in Brahman. By practicing the path of yoga, he becomes situated in full absorption on the Supreme. Then, because his whole purpose was to please Krishna, then his devotion to Krishna increases. And as each one drops off, the karma drops off, then the jnana drops off, the yoga drops off, all he's left with is pure unalloyed devotion. So he's gotten the benefit of all these paths, but not by following them separately, but by following them in relationship to Lord. So this verse then summarizes the 7th and 8th chapters by explaining the supreme path of bhakti over all other methods of realization. Now Srila Prabhupada makes a point by placing these two chapters in context of the entire Gita. The words imam viditva indicate that one should understand the instructions given by Sri Krishna in this chapter and the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. One should try to understand these chapters not by scholarship or mental speculation, but by hearing them in association with devotees. Chapters 7 through 12 are the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. The first 6 and the last 6 chapters are like coverings for the middle 6 chapters, which are especially protected by the Lord. One is fortunate enough to understand Bhagavad Gita, especially these middle 6 chapters, in the association of devotees, then his life at once becomes glorified beyond all penances, sacrifices, charities, speculations, etc. For one can achieve all the results of these activities simply by Krishna consciousness. Any questions on this? This ends the chapter. Because it's a mechanical process, the yoga process. So you're trying to take advantage of the mechanics in the material world to advantage. So as one progresses, and as one is nearing the advanced stages, then fixing the life airs. What, in other words, the idea is you're going to leave the body and go to the spiritual realm. The yogi comes to the platform where he perfects his meditation, and then leaves the body, and goes to this next destination. So here this yogi can either go to the heavenly planets, can go to the Brahman, can merge into the body of the Lord. Or if he's a yogi, bhakti yogi, then he will use this process to take up the devotional service to the Lord. Either take it up in this life or go to the spiritual planets. But he's still using the mechanical process. Just as the Nishkam Karma yogi, he engages his prescribed duties in his devotional activities in the Lord's service. So he uses that as his method, while the yogi uses the body and his powers of meditation as his instruments. In other words, the conditioned soul has to use some instruments. One is he knows the material nature. That is where he has been fixed so keenly for the last, umpteen, billions of lifetimes. So now, using the same thing, he's going to purify himself. One is that's all, he can't see the spiritual. So he has to approach the spiritual through the medium of the material. But by engaging it in Krishna's service, it takes on the quality of spiritual. It is spiritual. If something's considered material because it's Krishna's energy. Krishna doesn't see this material, he sees it as inferior. Right? It's non-conscious, it's inferior. But the living entity sees it as his to enjoy. Therefore it's called the material world, to distinguish it. But when one acts within the material world with the purpose simply to please the Lord, then technically he's not in the material world. He's in the inferior energy, but he's within the Lord's energy. And this understanding means you understand the energies of the Lord, so thus one becomes situated on the platform of Brahman. And all activities that one performs are considered Brahman, because they're not being done for any material purpose. So the yogi just uses the medium of the body and the life airs. And so you fix them between the eyebrows, then that the memory you fix in one place, you can bring in the senses, everything. Once one's accomplished that, then one moves the life airs to the top of the head, because from the top of the head, that's where it'll leave from. Yogis are very, very careful not to allow any other gate the life airs to go out. So the different asanas that one does, then one blocks all the 9 gates to get the life airs up there. In the beginning, when the airs are still moving the body, especially, then he's got to do this. But once he stops the breathing, it's a little easier. They have things where they close, I say. Yeah, they by use of the heels when they sit in their posture, then they sit on one heel and that closes the anus, and then they put the other heel on top of the genital. That closes those 2 gates. Then the airs can't go out and leave that way. And then as they bring it up, then they, by generally how they position the tongue, then they stop the air from going up into, it stops it from coming out the mouth, stops it from going into the nose, and that's also the path of the ears and the eyes. So in that way, then the life airs just stay in the straight line. So then you bring it to the between the eyebrows once you can control the energy, the kundalini. Then once that's done, the breath has been stopped, you've controlled the senses and all that, then you take it to the top of the head and leave the life air there. But your meditation is on the heart, because that's where the Paramatma is. So that's why those 2 things are happening at once. So the yogi also has to do 2 things at once. He has to deal with the life airs and think of the Lord. So in the same way as the Nishkam Karma Yogi, also, he performs his prescribed duties and he has to think of the Lord. So the principle is the same. Whatever the process is, it's always the same. That's why it's called yoga, because you're doing the activity, the mechanical process, and remembering the Lord. It's just the mechanical process changes from Astanga to Yajna to the deity worship to chanting the holy name. You know, like that. And then once in yoga, the Satyuga, then or these other ages, they could easily go to the forest. But in this age, it's very difficult. You know, you see, even Dhritarashtra was able to go to the forest and follow this system and leave his body. But in this age, it doesn't work like that so good. So just chanting the holy name and performing your prescribed duties while remembering the Lord, then it works. But the principle is the same. If one understands the principles, then there's no difference in the yoga process. You just know, it's just like you understand cooking, you understand pots. You don't think that a karai is one whole separate tattva and, you know, and it has a system of cooking. Everything's very different from cooking in a regular pot, you know, with the flat bottom pot. You know, it goes on the fire, it uses the same principles. But if I want to deep fry something or cook a vegetable, I have to stir fry or something, I'll use a karai. You know, if I want to boil something or like that, I don't have to do anything, I'll use a flat bottom. Because you understand the process of cooking is the same, just which pot I use, what is my medium. So one understands yoga, he understands that all these different methods of yoga described here are all the same principle. Just they have slightly different details according to our level of advancement. As we're more accustomed to dealing with material nature, we deal with it, the gross material energies. As we become more purified, then we can deal with the subtle. The subtle body becomes more prominent. Like that. And then as it becomes more, then we engage just specifically the remembrance and like that. Then we fix ourselves on this platform of being not the body, and then without any material desire, means they've been removed by this time, we take up your unalloyed devotional service, this ananya bhakti. So then it becomes very clear. It's just when Krishna says there's one path, it is just one path. We're thinking they give different results. No, just on that path there are certain material results. And they're different from the ones on Gyan, and ones different on Yoga, and went like this. But it's just one path. They're in a chronological order. But the living entities, especially in this age, the foolish living entities, think that they're all starting in the same point. I am sitting at my present position, and I can either start with the very basic principles of karma and advance, or with jnana advance or yoga in advance. They don't understand that, no, until you've gone through the karma and then the jnana, I can't get to the yoga. You can't sit down and do Ashtanga yoga. No one can do it. I mean, don't hear of any yogis when they teach their yoga classes talk about stopping the breath. Not anybody who's out making some money. I mean, you would lose customers really fast. You know, one, they won't be able to do it, and two, they'll just find it very difficult. Right? I mean, it's not that it's a breeze. It takes practice. There's one asana called, I think it's called Bandha Padmasana. That is the Padmasana, where you put the bottoms of the feet on the thighs. But this is, you put them as far in as possible, far towards the back. Then reaching the right hand behind the back, you grab the left big toe. And taking the left hand, you take it behind the back and grab the right toe. So in this position, your back is perfectly straight, but you are fixed in position. So this will not be used as a perfectional asan. You know, you'll use just the regular Padmasan or Sukhasan or one of those asans, Swastikasan, but you won't use this. This one is specifically important in the stage when you're practicing stopping the breath. Because when you're practicing putting the ingoing air into the outgoing air, you know, your first attempt may not be successful. So, you know, we've experienced like holding the breath underwater. You know, and when you do for a long time, as it nears the end, the body actually starts reacting very violently. You know, the lungs try to breathe, the body starts just going into spasms. So this asana is for controlling those spasms. So as the body starts bouncing around and, you know, almost falling over, it's a very stable position in which they can sit. And like this, practice not breathing for 5 minutes until they turn blue, and then take their breath, and then after some time try again with, you know, a little bit more refinement. Maybe they get 6 minutes this time, or, you know, the next time a little bit more, until finally they can get it, you know, there's no problem, they just stop the breathing. But in that interim state, it's pretty wild, you know, so you can imagine, you know, a room full of people, you know, kind of turning blue and bouncing around the room. So it's not a very, how do you say, commercially viable scenario, you know. So you don't hear them talking about this. It's not possible in this age. You know, a few may be there in the Himalayas. You never hear them. Never will hear them. I probably mentioned in the, in the Kumbh Mela, when he was there in 77, his devotees were making some comment about, you know, everybody's here is bogus or something. Prabhupada said, no, there's a few yogis like that who come down. And generally they're the ones who will come down. The really pukka ones in the Himalayas will go into a sacred river or pond up there, and then at the auspicious moment they will come up at the Sangam, go back down, you know, take their bath in the Sangam at the proper moment, and then come back up in the sacred river up in the Himalayas and go back to their ashram. They won't even bother coming. He says, otherwise, sometimes you see these very young, youthful-looking yogis like that. He says they may be hundreds of years old because they stop the breathing. When you stop the breathing, you don't age. Your life is, you have so many breaths. So if you have a million breaths, if you stop breathing after 100,000 breaths, then you're only that old. So if you stop breathing for 100 years, when you start breathing again, you'll look exactly the same. Even though now you're, you know, 100 and, you know, however old you are. And then after doing some activities, you stop the breath again, like that. So they may be hundreds of years old. But in this age, it's not possible. It's just not viable. And Prabhupada wasn't saying that these persons are devotees and they're just enamored by that they can stop the breath. You know, Prabhupada made the point, even the frogs do that, like Kumbhaka Yoga. Stopping the breath is called Kumbhaka Yoga. So like Hatha Yoga is someone who's totally absorbed and stuck on asanas. That's all they do. So Kumbhaka Yogi is one who is stuck on stopping the breath. Or Dhyana Yogi is someone who's just into meditation. But none of them are interested in the supreme goal. If they're interested in the supreme goal, they're called Bhakti Yogis. But they're using the method of Astanga Yoga to get to Bhakti. While we use the Krishna recommends, because Arjuna's rejected it in Dwarpara Yuga, so let alone now, as a viable method. So Krishna recommends this Nishkam Karma Yoga. To follow the principles of yoga, but with using the medium of prescribed duties. Does that make any sense?
Thank you.
Next specifically, I'm not sure. But generally, we see thinking of him as, you know, as his friend charioteer. But he also knows he's the Supreme Lord, because that is the point. In the Dwarka, the Ras is there, but they also, because of following Vidhi, they do know he's the Supreme Lord. But that doesn't shadow. It just shadows their love for Krishna in the way that it keeps them within the realm of rules and regulations. But it doesn't in any way hamper their rasa with him. Right? While in Vrindavan, you know, they don't worry about it at all, that he's God. So their relationships is unimpeded by any dependence on Vidhi. You know? Well, then when you increase that Vidhi aspect more, then you see that you have to reduce the rasas. Because it's very hard to remember the Lord as the Supreme Absolute Truth and be in a parental relationship with Him. If you are the parents of God, then it would appear that you are the source of God. So it goes against the rasa. It just doesn't fit. Therefore, in Vaikuntha, you only find dasya. We earlier than it was mentioned, we tried to think of the Lord as Shyamasunda. Yeah, I think Prabhupada gave the shloka, Premanjana Churita Bhakti Loka, right? Yam Shama Sundaram Achintya Guna Swarupam. Yeah, whatever is our, means it's a natural progression also. Name is first. And from the name then comes the form, then we remember the qualities, then the pastimes. So it's a natural progression. So whatever we can remember. But if nothing, at least chant, you know, while chanting and like that. Or just remember we're doing it for Krishna, trying to please Krishna with it, you know, like that. Because that's his first instruction. The aspect where we're more situated on the karma side of Nishkam Karma Yoga is the aspect of that we're doing the duty. We want to do it nicely for Krishna, but the result's his, it's for him. And in this way we can remember we're doing this for Krishna. No, you have to concentrate on what you're doing. No, you have to concentrate. That's what he says also, it takes practice and determination. You know, because you'll see, let's say you're cooking, like you mentioned there, you're cooking. But you get ladies who've been cooking since they're little kids. When they're older, they can sit there and carry on full conversations while everything's going on. No problem. I see that most amazing advance. They have these foot knives, you know, the boti, and they'll be cutting vegetables, you know, especially something like lau or, tor, the heart of the banana tree. It's cut very, very fine. So they have whatever it is in their hand. They're not even looking at the knife, and they're just chopping away, you know, so it's different than. I mean, it's one thing if you're chopping away, you have the vegetable on a wooden cutting board and you're chopping like that. You know, you have to watch your thumb at one point. But here is that they're pressing the vegetable onto the knife so they can press only up to the point they touch their thumb. And they're doing this very fast. You know, they'll be doing 3 or 4 cuts a second. And they're not even looking, and they're just carrying on laughing and joking with the other ladies that are also sitting there cutting their vegetables. Right? So this is with practice and determination. They practice cutting sabji since they're 6 years old, and their determination determined to talk to Jalpa. So that combination has produced this. So it is possible. But it just takes that practice and determination. I think that's the last 6. See. 30. Lord Sri Krishna said, O mighty armed son of Kunti, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and by detachment. So, can be done, just takes time. That's why we're in the stage of sadhana bhakti. We practice. Right? So in the beginning stages, then it's more difficult. And at the end stages, then it becomes much more easy. It's still practice. But then as we come to the platform of spontaneous devotional service, then that kind of thing, that practice becomes very easy. Because you think of Krishna as a person. You know, you think you want to do for him. So it's just like let's say you have to do a service, a particular service. And it's just because it's your service. So you're just doing it because every day you go in at, 9 o'clock and come out at 12 and you're doing it. But let's say on a festival day or something that's very prominent, okay, today is Janmashtami. So then it's much easier to, really think, oh, I'm making this nice for Krishna. Though every day we're cooking for Krishna. Somehow or another, those days we tend to forget. But on this day, it makes it spread, then we remember. You know? Like that. Does that make any sense?
Paul also says that Arjuna wasn't sitting on the battlefield meditating, he was actually fighting. So he had to be very attentive because, there's arrows flying towards his body. And, how does he actually think of it? He has to be very attentive to
dodge
arrows.
Because you know that you're doing it for him, couldn't you? Means that how is it Arjuna on the battlefield could remember Krishna? Because he's having to absorb himself very much in counteracting the arrows sent by the enemy. So it takes a lot of attention. So the process of Nishkam Karma Yoga is that you are performing your duties. You know that the duty is to be done for Krishna. So you have to be attentive to the duty. But you ultimately know that it's for Krishna. And you're not attached to the result. You're trying to do it the best for Krishna. Like that. So those moments will come when you have that space. But otherwise you concentrate on what you're doing. But then in moments when it's not so intense, then one will naturally remember at that time and contemplate on what before and the quality of how we were performing or remembering or like that. So that intensity is there and it absorbs us. But then with that same intensity, when the intensity of the physical activity stop, then the practices is then once you continue with the same intensity, but now on remembering and understanding the Lord. So it just shows that one can do more. By doing more, then it gets rid of, you forget about many times material desires, you forget about, eating and sleeping. You get very absorbed in the service, you're very tired, and then something comes up and it gets you somehow to wake up and go for hours and then you forgot you were sleepy or forgot to eat or forgot to go to the bathroom or you get so absorbed. So those things show that you can go on without these activities. So that intensity is important. That occasional or regular intensity like that, then you can start to give up the material attachments, material identities. You start to see that the activity is what makes you happy. I mean, while you're doing that, you're totally absorbed, very happy, and you forgot about all these things that supposedly are supposed to make you happy. You're eating, you're sleeping, going to the toilet, all these different things. Then it becomes... So the quality of service is important. Means one can only sit down and give up See, that Krishna makes this point very strongly, that because Arjuna immediately brings up this point. As soon as he's saying two things, and he says, well, you know, it sounds like it's two different things. So Krishna says, okay, if I'm supposed to use my intelligence and remember you and all these things, then why are you asking me to fight? Because he hasn't put together is that the remembrance and the prescribed duties, they go together. So we can only sit down and only think of Krishna when we've come to that platform of purity that we can do that. Otherwise, what will happen is that we won't have that stage of purity. And because of that lack of purity, then the mind will think of so many things. We may sit down, but the mind will think of all kinds of stuff. It's interesting. You find that many times when you have nothing to do, you get nothing done. You have the whole day. And amazingly, you'll find, let's say, if we say tomorrow, you have no work, no responsibilities, nothing you have to do. You can do whatever you want. And you'll generally find that, you know, when evening time comes and it gets dark, you still have rounds left, you still haven't washed your clothes, you know, and it's just somehow or another, it just all disappears. Because the mind, until we're that pure, then it's very hard to engage. So therefore, the prescribed duties regulate us, make sure the activities are there, and then the mind becomes more fixed. So it's like, there's a saying, if you want to get something done, ask a busy person. Because a person with nothing to do can't get anything done. Someone who's already busy, then can get something done. So it's like that. In the beginning, then, the essential, in the beginning means until basically we come to the Brahma-Bhuta platform. Then, which means the platform for us, you know, the border of Asakti and Bhava, like that. So, that means one will be performing prescribed duties. Though in the beginning, the consciousness will be more on the activity. And as we progress, it will be more on the understanding, the workings of the activity. Right? In the beginning, we're on the technique of the activity without attachment. And then as we progress, it's starting to the workings of the activity. It means how the material nature, the body, the soul, desire, and all these different things, how those are functioning. Because right? The technique will be habit by now, by that time. And by one becomes purified. So the jnana side, that's why the Nishkam Karma Yogi is called the jnani in the four pious persons who surrender. Because he's more interested in the workings, how it functions, the principles behind it, the fundamentals. While the Sakam is more interested in the externals. I do my activities, but I want some of the fruit. That either the fruit of karma or the fruit of jnana. Well, the jnani doesn't want the fruit of either. He just wants to serve the Lord. But he will have, you know, this vast understanding of his position, the Lord's position, the material energy, and how to engage them.
Another thing I was thinking about a few more times, and that time when they were going to court, the German government was taking the answer to court. I can't remember what for. Prabhupada was getting into it. He said, alright. He said, then you have to give them our books. He said, this is our evidence. Give it to all the judges and the jury and say, this is our evidence that we're not a cult or something. I think Jesus has been a cult. So you read these books and you will understand. And so he was pretty fixed on this point that you get to read our books, our evidence, and then our evidence. And it's going on in the day by day. He's really involved with it. And then the day they went to court, the day before, then the German government just dropped it. The case. They just dropped it. personal family. And Abhinav Prabhupada during that time, he said, he said, what did he hear about? What did he hear about this place in Germany? He said, they dropped it. How did they do that? I wonder why they did that. And then he's going on for about, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, he's to himself, and he's going, I wonder why they're doing that. And I told Satsri Maharaj, he said, Prabhupada often does that. It's like he's talking to Krishna. And he goes on, and he's talking away. His mind's absorbed in the subject matter, in this case the German court case. It's like talking to Krishna about it. He said he does it often, so as if Krishna's there, and he's like, why did they do that, Krishna? So his attention is like, he's thinking about the court case, he's like talking to Krishna. I was just thinking maybe Arjuna was doing what we're doing, like that. Well, he's buying an arrow with Krishna, what should I do with Krishna? His attention is on there. I should count up this arrow fishing. And his attention is on the ears. That is just the thought of him.
That's right. It's also Krishna was sitting in front of him. The charioteer is in front of the archer. But there's many times, at least there's conversations. Krishna tells him to do this, now see that person there and that. It's a very close relationship. That's what's many times, just on the other side, is many times very much misunderstood about the Vedic system, is that we just are looking at it from results. Okay, who's got the power? Who's got the money? You know, and the influence. And by that, then, devotees choose, I think, well, I'd rather be a Brahmin or a Kshatriya or like that. No one wants to be the Shudra. But we see here is that the relationship between the charioteer, who's a Kshatriya, and the charioteer, who's a Shudra, then is very close, very intimate. I mean, the lives depend upon each other. The charioteer doesn't drive properly, he can get himself in the wrong position. The charioteer has to be able to drive so that the best possible option for a shooting at the other is there. You know? Like that. At the same time, is the charioteer doesn't have any weapons, so his life is dependent upon the archer. And so it's very close, very, very intimate. So the relationship between the Shudras and who they work for, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, is very close. And it's very personal. You know, there's a lot of exchange and all these things, you know. Prabhupada was talking about, I forget who he was talking about. One of the big personalities in Calcutta at the time when he was there, I don't know if it was Bosch, the head of the Bosch Chemicals, or he was talking about Subhash Chandra Bosch or someone else. He said that many times, and you know, I mean, things would get, you know, in the day it builds up and all that, he'd go out for a drive, you know, just to kind of unwind. And he said many times he talked for hours with his driver. You know, driver is Shudra. You know, so is he talk with him, you know, and take his opinion on things and discuss things and, you know, things in the family because they've been around. Shudras are respected because of their age. Age means they've seen a lot, they've heard a lot, they've experienced a lot. You know, and when it comes to the material nature, they're more absorbed. Tendency to be absorbed, so they can say a lot when it comes to experience, what's the best thing to do in this, or this one said this and that. Many times they can give first class advice, not based on shastra, based on experience. So the learned person, in other words the dvija, who knows the shastras, then judges what has been advice has been given by the shudra against the shastras. What he says sounds very practical, it also fits with the shastra, then it will be done. So there's not a problem of, you know, who's telling who's what, but the etiquette is still there. Even though the dvija may be respecting the shudra and taking advice from him, but still the shudra will never think that, you know, now I'm the big man and I'm guiding and this in any way think he's going to he's not going to control or like that. He'll work for the benefit of who he's serving, because the person who's serving is protecting them and taking care. So it's a very personal system, very personal, very nice interaction. You know, that's why it's, you see that Brahmin in South India who couldn't read, and his spiritual master told him to study Gita. So he was sitting down, and you know, because his guru told him, he sat down and started looking at the book, but it was upside down. So all the other Brahmins were coming and laughing and saying, what kind of pundit are you? Can't even read this, that. When Lord Chaitanya came, he saw that the Brahmin was, you know, crying. And he asked him why, because he could also see that the book's upside down. So he could understand he doesn't know how to read. So, but he was just saying, just thinking of how, out of the affection of the Lord for his devotee, he took the position of his charioteer. So that intimacy that's there puts him in one sense under his own devotee as the charioteer. And then the intimacy that's there between the archer and the charioteer, and just, you know, all the whole thing, of just the whole rasa of the whole thing. You know, he wasn't thinking of the philosophy, just the rasa of it. And I think Lord Chaitanya then embraced him and said, you are actually, you know, the pundit of Gita. You actually understand. You know, these others, they're not pundits. Like that. So it's a very wonderful thing. Like that. This whole rasa of Krishna is the charioteer. Like it's very special. And because of the relationship, then it's been done very well. Krishna is looking after Arjuna's benefit, and Arjuna is always thinking of Krishna and trying to please him by fighting. But we see another example of equally, if not more qualified archer, and at least other than Krishna, the best charioteer available, with Karna and Salya. But Salya's point is, I'll drive your chariot as long as you don't tell me what to do. You know, we see in the beginning of Gita, Arjuna tells Krishna, now take my chariot in between the armies. So he's told him what to do. So even more the intimacy and the surrender. You know, the point was that Salya is a king, he's not a Shudra. So his point is, he's telling Salya is a king, he's acting as a charioteer. Karna is a charioteer who's acting as a king. And Salya knows that. So he tells Karna is that you may be a charioteer, you know, and acting as a king, but I know chariot driving better than you, and I am a king. So you don't tell me what to do. I'll take you to where are the best angles and things for fighting. If you tell me what to do, you know, you're on your own. So we can see the pride of both, because there's no rasa there. Salya was not in any way impressed with Karna. Because we can see why, because then later on, Karna started dealing with him very roughly. You know, he's the charioteer, he's the archer, you're the charioteer, I tell you what to do. So normally that would be the case, but seeing that the charioteer is such a respectable person, that has to be, you can't just go on the principle of, I'm the kshatriya, here's the charioteer, so I'm in the position, you know, I'm in the position of the senior position to him, because he's in the position of the shudra. That's okay as long as that was his only qualification, but he does have the influence of a king, because he is one. So influence is more respectable than age. So Karna is not cultured enough to understand this point. Therefore, Salya just gets up and leaves. So due to lack of culture, Karna can't behave properly. And Salya, because of ego, you know, Kshatriya ego, then also can't. But here, with the Krishna Arjuna, because of their mutual affection, their love, then it works very nice, even though one's the Supreme Lord and the other's, you know, a human being. that is. So if one can understand these things, then the whole process, devotional process works, and the process of prescribed duties works. Because a devotional process means how to reestablish rasa with the Supreme. And the following of prescribed duties means how to properly situate oneself in rasa in the material world. But Krishna is saying, do that without desiring the fruit. So therefore you're not getting a material fruit for situating yourself in your prescribed duties, neither sensual nor emotional. So you get a spiritual result. Even though you're performing the externalities of what would look like just regular religious activities. So when Krishna says, give up all religions and surrender unto me, then he won't be contradicting whatever he said before about doing the prescribed duty for him. What he's saying is, give up all religions, because the religion, material religion, has a short-term goal and method to get it. So he says, give up all that, all those short-term goals, and surrender to me. So you follow the prescribed duties, but give up what is the religious result you'll get from it. Right? Karmakanda, the religious result you'll get is, you know, heavenly pleasures. So you give that up. So that's all removed. And we are left with just the devotional activity. Right? But we're not situated on pure unalloyed devotional service. We're situated on the platform of activity. So we do that activity rejecting the result, the religious result we get, but not the activity itself. But now we'll do it for Krishna. Because he says, surrender unto me. That. Then it becomes very clear, and also in the Bhagavatam. Because you see all these devotees are performing the prescribed duties, but for Krishna. So Kaitava Dharma means you're performing prescribed duties for some other purpose other than going back to Godhead. So that keeps you in the material world. So that's cheating. It's not real. It's not actually religion. Religion means getting you back to Godhead. Means the Nishkam Karma Yoga, its main emphasis is actually on the jnana. That's why the devotee in that position is called a jnani. Its main is on the transcendental knowledge. But the medium through which you perform your service is the prescribed duties, is the karma. So nishkam karma, nishkam means without desire, so that can only come if there is understanding the philosophy and you become a devotee. So nishkam karma yoga has to be a devotee performing devotional activities, but through the medium of karma rather than through the medium of jnana or the medium of yoga. You know? And the one naturally goes into the other. Nishkam Karma Yoga naturally progresses to the stage of pure unalloyed devotion, taking support from these other yoga systems. This is all one system. Yoga is one system, though it may have various tools you can work with. So the essential tools of each system is there in a chronological order to elevate you back to Godhead. Anything else? If so, we'll end here. Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Jaini Tai Gaur, Samaveta Bhakta Brinda ki, Jaini Tai Gaur. Tomorrow's ninth chapter, the most confidential knowledge.